Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 15th of August, 2018. And I want to talk about the Islamic Republic of Iran. When Hillary Clinton was running for president, she made it clear, I think it was at the VFW, that upon her election, she was going to attack Iran. And she meant that militarily. I try as I might, I can't figure out any threat that Iran poses to the United States, but as I look deeper, I was able to see it. Iran is one of the most successful countries in the world, whether it be economically or educationally, scientifically, oil and natural gas. Her economic future is extraordinary. She is really on the verge of superpower status. And this has been kept out of the American press. And this is the reason why Iran is such a threat. This is the reason why someone like Clinton will go so far as to vow to attack this country for no clearly obvious reason. However, as an aside, I will invite my listeners to my website, www.rushjournal.org, and use my donation button to give money to this research, which, as most of you know, I'm full-time. This is all I know how to do. This is all I can do. And for the information that I provide, which is completely original, it's very much imitated, but certainly not duplicated anywhere. And what we're going to talk about today in terms of the Iranian Revolution and what it means in 2018 is one of these reasons that I deserve your support and that I've earned it. Because I'm going to talk about a few things with Iran that almost no one knows. Iran's successes in every respect have been kept out of the press, largely because, well, for a whole bunch of reasons, but one of the main reasons is that it's one of the least globalized economies in the world. There is a globalization index, and Iran is almost at the bottom. And of course, so many of these countries at the bottom are doing very, very well. With the exception of some of these countries that are so poor that are simply not a part of the global economy, but those that have some kind of economy are doing very well. Globalization is a recipe for disaster, wherever it goes. But Iran, in the Islamic world has, and again, there's a big difference between, Sunni and Shia Islam. In terms of Russian Orthodoxy, Shia Islam has been far greater of an ally than the highly Judaic, Sunni branch. And, Iran and much of Iraq are majority Shia. Getting Iran and Iraq to fight each other in the late 80s was an essential plank in the British and American international agenda. But imperialism comes in many forms, and the purpose of Iran is to fight this imperialism. It takes the form of both cultural and economic domination. And there are few countries who are willing to take a stand, but all of these come at a great price. And one of these is Iran. And the stand that they take is very much Russia's stand, Venezuela's, Bolivia's, North Korea's, Burma. It's the same thing, Belarus. It's to challenge the notion that liberal imperialism, that model of American empire, is certainly not universally true, not inevitable. It's far from flawless and cannot ever be the standard by which one can judge others. But that is the American exceptionalist concept, that the American liberal empire is universally true, flawless in its ideals, and the standard by which all countries should be compared. But the Iranian record in fostering a multi-party, albeit Islamic, democracy, I don't know what other kind of democracy you could have in an Islamic country, and very high economic growth, bears out Iran's position as the right. The book by Ray Takian, Guardian to the Revolution, Iran and the World in the Age of the Ayatollahs, from Oxford University Press in 2009, goes very far in explaining how the Islamic Republic is stacking up against the American enemy. When I say American or Western, I'm referring to liberal capitalism, because today they're one and the same. Part of the imperial liberal element of the postmodern empire is to argue that religious societies are inherently repressive. In contrast, secular parties and societies, by virtue of their secularism, are freer and hence healthier. Now, this is a wild and provable speculation, but it lies at the root of American imperialism, and especially in the Islamic and Slavic worlds. But in reading this book, the conclusion can be come to the conclusion that the West is in serious trouble, as authoritarian-led popular regimes the world over seem to be winning the hearts of the Third World, as well as registering very impressive economic numbers. So today, 2018, the Islamic world, as in the Slavic world, is quickly changing America's declination in Iraq, as well as the clear failures in Afghanistan. And you add to that Hezbollah's electoral triumph over Israel in 2006, the victory of the Russo-Syrian alliance, the defection of Turkey, the rise of Hamas as a democratic political party. This has sealed the West's fate. I have a book out called The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, American Failures in the Islamic World, and I argue pretty much the same thing here. That could be found on Ramada Press. But the Takia book and assorted economic databases, especially the World Bank and the CIA Factbook, shows Iran's success, but not just success, but a success in a very hostile political environment. The Iranian leadership is representative in the broad sense, but of course the overwhelmingly Islamic population has no interest in secular rule. Like in Israel, where all parties have to be formally Jewish, Iranian parties must be formally Islamic. And really there's no ethical problem with either, given the nature of those societies. But people like Takia, even though being published by Oxford University, is not anti-Iranian, and that's very rare. He describes the Ayatollah Khomeini, for example, as a man of remarkable intellect and tactical dexterity. However, in the same paragraph, he writes, Khomeini was capable of extraordinarily cruel behavior, inasmuch as he remained largely indifferent to the sufferings of his people when it came to imposing his ideological template on an unwilling Middle East. Now, that's a stupid comment in an otherwise very good book. And the problem with it is that there's simply no way of telling if this was opposed to the Middle East or if Iran even has a fraction of that kind of power. His revolution was a popular one. This alleged cruelty fails to mention that Iran is popular in the Middle East and is seen as almost an Islamic champion now that Iraq has been reduced to third world status. It's almost like these negative comments are occasional blurbs written to satisfy Western publishers. This might be the case, especially since it doesn't sit well with the rest of the argument. But the economic status, the economic statistics of Iran are some of the most impressive on the planet right now. And what I'm going to cite here now comes from either the CIA Factbook or the World Bank. Iran is a multi-party democracy with one of the most powerful economies on the planet. She's 14th in the world in the number of daily newspapers per capita and 8th for non-daily periodicals. She's the 18th largest economy in the world and also is the 18th most rapidly developing economy. Her life expectancy is 74 and for women is 76. She has the 4th highest government budget surplus. sees the eighth least indebted country on the planet, and her gold reserves are the eighth largest in the world. One of the most interesting successes is that Iran is 14th in the world in terms of wages relative to business expenses. This makes, relatively speaking, her workers some of the best paid in the world relative to overall business expenses. And part of this is because Iran has the sixth cheapest energy prices in the world. And Tehran is the most inexpensive capital city in which to live. And believe it or not, it's the number one in terms of growth in industrial and scientific innovation, according to the annual Science Matrix report of the UK. Those are very impressive. So you have about, you know, half of all private sector monies paid are in the form of wages. They're 24th in the world, so 24th out of 191, in the number of small and medium-sized businesses. There are about 1.3, 1.4 million of these. She has the ninth highest number of book titles published every year, and seventh in scientific texts. She's third in the world in terms of university enrollments. And as I said before, the globalization index is 162 out of 181, making her one of the least globalized countries on the planet. In addition to all this, she has one of the lowest suicide rates, but at the same time, she does have the highest rate, the number one highest rate of opiate addiction. Although I think that has something to do with the fact that it shares a very large border with Afghanistan. There's little doubt that the U.S. makes sure that this border is wide open. So you have the lowest suicide rates on the one hand, and yet high opiate addiction. That doesn't make any sense. It's got to be artificially, and there can be no question that sharing a very long border with Afghanistan is probably the main reason for this. And there's no doubt in my mind that the West is pumping opiates into that country, because we know it's pumping opiates into their own countries. And because of the low suicide rate, very low rate of mental illness, the opiate addiction being the number one in the world, it might be Afghanistan, it could be you know, some country in the West. They just manipulate the figures. This comes from the World Health Organization. I don't know how true it is. But, of course, you know, drugs are being sent into that country as a weapon of war by the United States. But the truth is that Iran is one of the healthiest countries on the planet. So without American sanctions, she would be doing even better. This is occurring as the U.S. has declared war on the country. She has huge defense expenditures. And she's still suffering the high casualties from the war with Iraq, not quite 30 years ago. Iran would be a dominant world power by now. But the good news is that Russia and China, Pakistan, and much of Latin America are compensating for these problems caused by the West. And then even previous to that, the Shah and the sanctions and her problems before 1979. Late 80s and early 90s, and this was during the war, Iran grew an average of 10% a year with a very low unemployment level. Now, in the early 2000s, this changed. GDP growth remained high, but the pressures of the American Depression between 2008 and 2012 caused some problems. As I've mentioned, she has a tremendous positive trade balance, has the lowest level of, one of the lowest levels of indebtedness. Actually, she does have the lowest level of indebtedness in any country in the world, and one of the greatest budget surpluses. Her inflation has been relatively high, and her interest rates today hover around between 9 and 12%. But still, it's respectable for a nation this young and for a society that's growing so rapidly. Of course, the Iranian currency is under state control and is not under banking control. Oil accounts only for 50% of this growth, and that's mostly in exports. The dominant export is gas, not oil. And it just shows that the Iranian model, which is nationalist, which doesn't permit usury, is a superior model than the United States. Iran is a multi-party democracy. There's a Modern Thinkers Party there, Party of Engineers, which specializes in scientific development, the Combatant Clergy Association, the Pro-Revolutionary Islamic Coalition Party, the Moderation and Development Party. Then there's the Reformist Office for Strengthening Unity, the Nationalist Religious Coalition of Iran. These are all major parties. They're quite different from one another. They're all Islamic, of course, but you couldn't function there without being Islamic. And the truth is that because of this, there's greater civic life in Iran than the two-party system in the U.S. And the author writes this. He says, the Islamic Republic of Iran has entered the 21st century in an enviable position. During its first three decades in power, the theocratic regime has survived a brutal war, domestic unrest, and American hostility. By choice and chance, Iran has now emerged as a leading power in the Middle East, whereby its preferences and predilections have to be taken into consideration as the region contemplates its future. Iran is by far the dominant power in the Middle East, and this is why Hillary Clinton was to be installed, and when she lost, the regime went bonkers, because it was meant, you know, the system was supposed to be attacking Iran. It was supposed to be a major war with Iran. So the U.S. wants a war on three fronts: China, Russia, and against Iran in Central Asia. The U.S. can't win one of those wars, let alone three at the same time. This is Hillary Clinton's point of view, John McCain's point of view. Both Republicans and Democrats accept this insanity as actual foreign policy. So it's the end of history, okay, but it's countries like Iran and Russia that are reaping the benefits. American debt, her global bad reputation, and her arrogance mean that the U.S. is becoming less and less relevant as the dollar begins to melt away. Iran and the Iranian model, religious nationalism is the future, and governments are focused on its culture and faith will be dominant, not the ideologies of the capitalists. Her approach is a realistic one. States remain in charge, and in fact, they grow in strength. The globalist utopia is not taken seriously outside of the United States. The alliances that Iran has made, especially since the sanctions were clamped down on the country, make her almost invulnerable to external pressure. Now, while the author doesn't say so directly, these media-staged Western finance revolutions, of course, are anything but spontaneous. A country like the United States with no money, domestic unrest everywhere, no national idea, really has only the internal media warfare to use against its enemies. China, Russia, and Iran are three places where this imported revolution has failed. And that failure is not lost on American elites. Taqi's analysis of Iran's relations with China is accurate and edifying, not only in that he stresses the common American enemy as unifying force, but he says, both states were very anxious about the emerging unipolar international system and the prospect of unrivaled American primacy. Well, that anxiety has passed. And it can't be denied. Relative to Russia, the author states, for its part, Iran comprehended that one way of fending off American pressure was to cultivate a close economic security partnership with Russia. An even more surprising move, the two powers cooperated in Central Asia. Since much of the Islamic world is not part of the Iranian hegemony, backing Russia against the semi-Islamic powers in Chechnya, for example, made good politics. It also shows how Islamic peoples can never be considered a monolithic group by any means. The Shiites have always been pro-Russian. The fomenting of war in Syria, both by the U.S. and its so-called allies, has also estranged whatever goodwill there was between Moscow and Washington, and Peking and Washington. And these are all ultimate victories for Iran, who, of course, are longtime allies of the Assad government in Damascus. The American taxpayer, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is exhausted for paying for these no-win wars as the Islamic world, the Slavic world, the East Asian world is becoming wealthier, more politically experienced, and a fielded guerrilla, as well as regular armies, that the overstretched, indebted, and cash-strapped U.S. cannot handle. Careful alliances with the European Union, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, mean the end of any form of unilateral American end of history. The author we're dealing with here quotes Martin Indyk with respect to the Iran-Iraq war. He says, "We do not accept the argument that we should continue the old balance of power game, building up one at the expense of the other. We reject that approach not only because of bankruptcy was demonstrated in Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. We reject it because of the clear-headed assessment of the antagonism that both regimes harbor towards the U.S. and its allies in the region. And we reject it because we don't need to rely on one to balance the other." Now, this shows the root of American failure in the region, what he said. What I'm saying here is that it implies that the fate of the region should be decided in Washington. By allies, I guess he means Israel. There are no other allies in the area. But saying so would further confirm Islamic suspicions about American goals in the area. There was no intrinsic evil in Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, no less than the evil of creating that country in the first place. Antagonism to the U.S. is seen as a sin of their foreign policy, unaware of American fault in that regard too. But no one would deny that last sentence. The U.S. needs all the help it can get. But today that's very little. Even in Europe, Great Britain remains the only reliable ally, and even that's increasingly questionable. As the author sums up the fate of the U.S. this way, even the perennially suspicious House of Saud has settled on a policy of integrating Iran into the existing Gulf framework instead of isolating and ostracizing it. That has not been dealt with in the American press, but with the Russo-Syrian victory in that country, Iran's growth to even beyond hegemonic status in the area, Iran is seen as a power of great strength. The U.S. doesn't have the manpower, the political will, or the strength to take on Iran, even given the present alliance system in Asia. Or I should say, because of the alliance system in Asia. So he writes, "Moreover, U.S. allies will assess their capabilities and vulnerabilities, shape alliances, and pursue their interests, all the while understanding that they are susceptible to an Iranian influence predicated on religious and economic ties. A containment strategy built on a porous Arab solidarity is bound to fail." Because no one wants to back the U.S. there. They don't want to do it on political grounds, they don't want to do it on religious grounds, and they certainly don't want to do it on economic grounds. The former chief executive of that country, President Rafsanjani, a few years ago, he wanted his cake and eat it too. He sees a possibility for a more compartmentalized relationship with the U.S. So the concept, as he says here, is that Iran would resist America's cultural influences, yet resume cooperative communal dealing. But that's a failed policy from the Iranian point of view. The significant thing is the U.S. is not a major trading partner of Iran. The issue is relatively moot. It's also naive to separate economic dealings from cultural ones. American media culture is both a powerful and concentrated capitalist enterprise and culture in the broadest sense. The previous president, Rafsanjani, his moderation might be a good thing, I guess. But preserving the traditional culture is something that both right and left in the West can agree on. The author seems to be a promoter of Rafsanjani's pragmatism without dealing with his problems in any detail. Now, on the other hand, the new president, Hassan Rouhani, Rafsanjani's successor, he sees the Islamic government as a foundation for long-term economic policy. Like many populists, he condemns wealth inequality and has a generally Keynesian approach to economics. Like all small, nationally-minded states, he advocates targeted investment and import substitution. Now, you can't really read the American press when it comes to this, because all Iranian presidential candidates are called reformists and centrists. It's just wishful thinking and wish fulfillment. All politicians call themselves reformists. It's a ridiculous term, and it shows you that they don't know what they're talking about. When these guys refer to a president as a reformist or centrist, they're admitting that they don't know anything. Economically, he rejects what lazy American reporters say about him. He believes in economic planning. He believes in directed subsidies and firm state control over investment. This has been extremely successful for Iran in the past. But contrary to what everyone said about him when he first was elected, he seeks to remove himself from any economic ties with the West. This is exactly what the journalists in the West said he wasn't. This is why you can't trust anything that they say. It's like if they project their wishes loudly enough onto a country that it will come true. That's pretty much all they have at this point. But the Islamic Republic really seeks only ties with its neighbors in the Islamic world. That's where its power base is. They're an integral part of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Non-Aligned Movement. And they're also part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the single most significant organization on the planet. But given Western embargo, what these embargoes usually do is strengthen the country that it's directed against. Latin America has been a target of Iranian alliance building. It's been extremely successful. Last few years, ties between Iran and Brazil and Iran and Bolivia have developed. Iran and Cuba, since the fall of USSR, have been intensely consolidated through the non-aligned movement. Ecuador was, in fact, placed under sanctions because of its increased ties with Iran. And so that only had the impact of deepening ties between the two states even more. Iran has prospered within these sanctions. And they're symbolic regardless, because the U.S. doesn't have much influence over the Iranian economy. Armenia, China, Azerbaijan, three immensely significant allies of Iran. Bangladesh has a duty-free trade zone between the two countries. Bangladesh has also approached Iran for assistance both with nuclear power and gas refining. Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan have seen their bilateral trade numbers almost double over the last 6 years or so. As I said on this show many times before, one of the most interesting developments is the increasing alliance between Turkey and Iran. Bilateral trade between the two countries is massively increasing. It's gone up over 500% since 2000. As Turkey prepares to leave NATO, which is not really a day-to-day part of the press for obvious reasons, there has been an explosion of gas exports from Iran to Turkey. And Iran today supplies about 40% of Turkish gas. So there is no way Turkey could ever follow American sanctions or will follow American policy there at all. Turkey is already slated to invest almost $15 billion in phases 22 to 24 of the South Pars gas field, with half of this being exported from Iran to Turkey and from there to Europe. The Europeans will not follow American sanctions against Iran. So trade between the two countries now is about $20 billion, and it increases yearly at a tremendous rate. No one is listening to what the U.S. has to say. They're not obeying sanctions on Russia. They're not obeying sanctions on Iran. The U.S. is a paper tiger, and no one fears it, especially given the fact that the dollar is largely being rejected as a reserve currency. So the point of all this is that Rouhani and Rafsanjani, these two presidents, are creating Iran as a great power. The U.S. has been completely defeated in its dealings with Central Asia. And of course, American sanctions are ignored as the dollar continues its agonizing descent into irrelevance. Don't forget, Iran has the largest proven gas reserves in the world and the third largest proven oil reserves in the world. Her military is the world's seventh largest and is highly motivated. Now, in this show, we've talked about security strategy of 2018-2017. The roots of this are in the security strategy of 2015, which was yet another recalibration of American aggression on the planet, influenced by really 14 years of wars of attrition and the inability to dislodge anti-American forces in the Middle East and Central Asia. There has to develop a new vision. And from 15 to 18, which we dealt with in the Daily Nationalist a week ago, the American financial crisis, debt, high unemployment, make these old strategic commitments just completely untenable. And that's from the White House, 2015. It's one thing for a central vision to underlie policy decisions. It's necessary. It's quite another, though, when the vision has no connection to reality. And in terms of American defense policy, I've been dealing with this for many years now. The fact that all policymakers have to face is that if the American system is so desirable, then the use of force would be largely unnecessary. But present American problems make even the use of force insufficient to oppose its vision abroad. It's rejected. It's a failure. Economically, you know, the full integration of technology and capital, along with finance, means that kind of sanctions and kind of transactions are uncontrollable. The rapid exchange, you know, globalization brings about this rapid exchange of ideas and money that, you know, it's very difficult to enforce sanction on anybody. Digitizing social relations. The foreign policy of the U.S. can't ignore, you know, it can't really use typical state-based forms of coercion anymore. But it does alter the nature of American interests. One description of what American ideology is goes like this. The tolerance for all cultures, races, and religions, global opportunity for self-fulfillment, human dignity, freedom from exploitation, justice with compassion, and equality under the rule of law, sovereignty without tyranny, with assured freedom of expression, and the environment for entrepreneurial freedom and global prosperity. In other words, they say absolutely nothing. This isn't idealized, it's just words strung together. None of this has anything to do with the realities of international economics. The drive for profits, the failure of the American model, the destruction of the American worker, the destruction of the American family, makes a joke out of these slogans. The White House says this in that 2015 security document. The circle of peaceful democracies has expanded. The specter of nuclear war has lifted. Major powers are at peace. The global economy has grown. Commerce has stitched the fate of nations together. And more individuals can determine their own destiny. That is the exact opposite of the exact same document in 2018. What I just read there is from the National Defense Strategy of 2015. The exact opposite was uttered 3 years later. I dealt with it last week. Why? Well, we've already covered it. This show, my career, is based on explaining why. Because the American model is in such trouble. American failures are so blatantly obvious. Crisis is beyond repair now that being at peace can't work. There's no getting out of this depression. It's simply impossible. Debt is too high. Warfare is all they have left. But back in 2015, it proved that the White House didn't live in reality. The same reality that permits investment funds to flow into country X also permits those funds to be retracted when opportunities seem better elsewhere. So that means country X is now left with debt and high expectations that cannot be met. So, you know, after 1989, the notion that mutual advantage and converging interests, connections that strengthen and reinforce collective international security, you know, certainly have, you know, rhetorical power. But if this were the only reality, foreign policy wouldn't even be an issue. These realities create threats to the U.S., which are the corporate elements that work under the American flag. Failed states are a major casualty of global capitalism. Iran, having rejected American capitalism, is not a failed state. It's the exact opposite of this. It is far more successful than the United States. But still, to this day, the U.S. continues to believe its power is unmatched and its demands irresistible. These defense strategies, at least the unclassified versions, are almost to be laughed at. It doesn't, even if it were not true, it doesn't create a mandate for American involvement globally, though. But these ideals have no basis in reality. The U.S. can't retain the old Cold War strategies. Domestic restraints are too great. The crash of 2007-2008 have not been met with any recovery. Nothing has changed since then. The monstrosity of both private and public sector debt is such that discretionary spending is hardly existent. Engagement in the world requires money and national resolve, and the U.S. has neither, whether the public sector or the private sector. Now, part of the problem, of course, is that America's greatest asset is its market. Such a large number of people willing to buy the exports of other nations was never a good idea to irritate the U.S. But if private sector debt forces the reduction in spending, this important weapon, in fact the only weapon, becomes less potent. So this all comes down to the myth of American exceptionalism, which is based on the manipulation of word definitions and ideal, wispy concepts that lead to utter disaster. 9/11 was absolutely necessary to create the notion that the U.S. is facing this world of barbaric terrorists. Well, of course, no one believes that 9/11 was anything but an American-made, and certainly that it was a legitimate military target. And now, you know, we're dealing today with a massive purge, private sector purge of nationalist and right-wing media from the web. InfoWars has been removed from all web servers. Even my friend Jay's analysis has been removed. So many of my friends have seen their websites taken down by the hundreds. Tens of thousands of nationalists and right-wingers have lost their jobs. I've lost several university jobs for this reason. Battle lines are being very, very clearly drawn. So we go from, in 2015, this crap about, you know, self-determination of, you know, races and peoples, to a complete purge and a demand for very intensely violent ideological uniformity in America. At 3 years, a lot has happened. And most of it comes down to the U.S. dollar. But to make use of, to manipulate this, these emotional foundation for the use of force, these aren't tenable. There's a dizzying array of constraints that the U.S. simply has been defeated everywhere it's gone. So the concept, it comes down to the real problem is the lack of real evidence and the lack of rational analysis. Enemies are very ambiguous, but now, you know, to have a strong, large enemy that you could hate, like Russia and China, was necessary. The Islamic world was simply too ambiguous. It was too unknown. The alliances were always changing. No one knows anything about it. You couldn't really put a face on an opponent. And every propagandist knows you need to do that. The American Revolution, you needed George III, whether he had tons of power or not was irrelevant. You can't put a face on Parliament. Simple people need to have a face on power to be able to visualize it. Putin in Russia, Xi in China, Duterte in the Philippines, the Ayatollah in Iran. These are easy to personalize. And so, it comes down to, and these countries have done nothing wrong. They're extremely successful. They're more successful than the U.S., and their model is far superior. But that's what's changed over the last 3 years. Iran is, as I said before, the eighth largest gold hoarder in the world. I mean, the Iranian form of government is immensely successful at every single level. The U.S. has none of those. That's what's happened over the last 3 years. Now, there's two different kinds of coercion. I think most of you are familiar with this. Hard power, as some people call it, hard power. These are open coercion, you know, police, armies, etc. Soft power refers to influence. The levers that usually a private sector can use to force behavior is not backed necessarily by open violence. Hard power is usually run by the state. Soft power is usually run by corporations. The problem in the U.S. now is that the private sector is the state. That's what a republic is. A republic is the privatization of political power. The state is used by corporate powers and banks to do its bidding, things that it itself cannot do. And, of course, corporate power dominates everything. However, corporate power not only is not subject to the Constitution, but is protected by it. Because a corporation has every legal privilege that an individual will have, which makes the entire constitutional order a joke, because in no way is Warren Buffett equal to me in any respect, or any corporation. equal to any individual out there. So since the Constitution applies equally to Archer Daniels Midland as well as me, shows you what a joke it's really become. It doesn't make any sense. Smart power, as the regime says today, is the ability to balance both. So what's developing now, and I think Trump's victory has a lot to do with this, is conceiving America's security interests far more narrowly. It doesn't have the cash to use its military very much. And yet it's saber-rattling all over the place. Look, at the end of the early 1940s, the U.S. had failed to get out of the Depression. Nothing had worked. I mean, even packing the Supreme Court, completely subverting the constitutional order, as Lincoln had done, even this wasn't enough. All of these policies had to be rammed through by packing the court, making it into 9 members, which had not been before. The Constitution does give a number of members that the Supreme Court has to have. So, the constitutional order was completely subverted. All of this trying to deal with the Depression, and it all failed. The last option was warfare. And so the attack on Pearl Harbor had to be provoked, and they didn't care what they had to do. Reading the diplomatic cables between Japan and the U.S. shows that the U.S. is doing everything it could to get into World War II, to have a reason to get involved in it, and including throwing the anti-war Americans in jail, which were the majority of the population. But of course, Pearl Harbor, like 9/11, was good enough to silence a lot of dissent. The big difference is that the U.S. in 1941, and the U.S., whether it be 2001 or 2018, have absolutely nothing in common with each other. These two countries have nothing in common. In 1941, the U.S. was a relatively moral state compared to today. It was far more just. It made a lot more sense. It was far more unified. It had a stronger moral basis, had a stronger family basis. Today, there is no American nation. Everything has to be a matter of artificial power, either the state simply extracting more resources or corporations telling Americans what they're supposed to believe. Purging the right wing from the internet. And I believe that this has something to do with the upcoming false flag, which should terrify you. Throwing our people in prison in large numbers after Charlottesville and everything else, where we were outnumbering the left for the first time on the street. This is fear. I don't think the age of unilateral action ever really existed. And if it did, it was maybe from 1989, 2002, 2003. If it ever existed, that was a very brief window. And Putin and Russia, and of course the Chinese, very quickly took over and forced the U.S. to back down. The alliance system, including certain countries in Africa and Latin America, large number of allies in Latin America, the U.S. model is finished. The 2015 national security strategy, as opposed to what I dealt with last week, it's noteworthy for the fact that it links foreign engagement with domestic goals. Separating foreign policy and domestic policy is really getting to the point where it's almost, we really shouldn't even be separating these anymore. Foreign policy is based on domestic realities, and vice versa. In other words, there's a clear connection between domestic success economically, and the credibility of American action abroad. So today, it's very easy for the Iranian government to see the U.S. as what it is, deeply alienated, deeply indebted, materialist people with no right to lecture anyone. The society is drowning in drugs and lawsuits and divorce and familyless children and everything else, saturated in crime, violent and otherwise. Can you imagine what American society would be like if you took away the ability to declare bankruptcy and drugs, legal and illegal? Take those two institutions away, drugs of all kinds and bankruptcy. What would America be like? The place would utterly explode in one way or another within 5 years. It would take that long. As of right now, that's the only thing. Those two institutions, drugs and bankruptcy. There's something like 600,000 bankruptcies a month, which is almost inconceivable to me. From 2008 to today. That means most people have declared bankruptcy many, many times. And most institutions of one type, kind or another have done it. The use of lawyers to get windfall profits from people. Suing hospitals because the doctor made a mistake. I mean, this is the domestic reality that the U.S. is claiming is identical to freedom. So foreign policy doctrine that's presented, whether it be, the radically different 2015 and 2018 versions. National security at home and abroad, benefits from a foreign policy that shapes and influences global agendas, but they have to be connected to real palpable benefits to American labor. So the U.S. presence in Korea, for example, doesn't serve their interests at all. Americans died and bled so that South Korea can become the immensely powerful first world society it is. It's more than capable of defending itself against the North. Japan, too, the result of American blood in the Second World War. She would have been better off under the emperor, of course, because Japan was a highly advanced, highly successful economy under the militarists. But American power abroad doesn't require U.S. forces in these trigger areas. Free member of the Republican primary contender, Marco Rubio. He's still here about now and again. He's so completely irrelevant and cut off from any kind of reality. He says, back in 2015, he said, the U.S. is a global leader not simply because of superior arms, but also because of superior aims and values. Well, the U.S. is superior in neither of those areas. It's a very bad example of political reasoning. Be careful when politicians or academics or journalists criticize a country from the point of view of ideals. That's dishonest. An ideal is always going to be better than the day-to-day reality of politics. Day-to-day reality of politics is always going to be rough. It's always going to be difficult. It's always going to be corruption and problems. You can never allow someone to talk about abstract democracy and put it up against, Iran or North Korea or whatever. No, day-to-day democracy in the U.S., has to be put up against the day-to-day life of another country. There, a place like Iran is doing far better than the U.S. Russia's doing far better than the U.S. There's no entrepreneurship in the U.S. anymore. Credit's being soaked up only by the largest corporations. I mean, there's nothing left at that level. The ownership of stock is in the top 1% of the population and no one else. Debt is owned internationally, but also by that same 1%. Of course, corporations are drowning in debt. So Rubio says, U.S. is a global leader in ideals. That's a meaningless statement. These ideals only work unless you have actual results, and the U.S. doesn't have this. But Rubio's narrative, this concept of American chosenness and destiny. The White House jettisons rhetoric a few years ago, wants to be level-headed in the calculation of service in a global order, but Rubio, McCain, etc., would justify military intervention at any time for any reason. So 2015, you had a relatively, relative to the U.S., level-headed understanding of American aims. Admitting that the U.S. Military policy simply had been a failure, 3 years later, the exact opposite. Someone like Rubio makes no mistake that the guerrilla network, cyber terror, organized crime is what he's really talking about. But the American military is not trained to deal with that. It deals with governments, hierarchies, diplomatic protocol. Since Vietnam, American military action against these kind of movements has been a miserable failure. I mean, losses in Latin America against the drug lords. The loss in the Middle East, loss in Central Asia. Lost in Vietnam, lost in Korea, lost in Somalia, lost in Syria, lost in Mexico, lost in Peru. And yet, look at the Philippines. And in a year or so, Duterte has destroyed the drug lords there. Isn't that amazing? So the conclusion can only be that there was never any attempt to destroy the drug lords. This is democracy at a day-to-day level. But strategic restraint is something that the U.S. has no choice but to engage in. But if the dollar is going to die, if other countries are going to control currency, going to control energy trade, then the U.S. simply has to adjust accordingly. And the empire has to be dismantled, the military dismantled, and the U.S. slowly but surely decompose into its constituent elements. Whether it be the South, Texas, New England, California, whatever it is. Objectivity, a clear notion of purpose, and a detailed functional plan are a minimum needed for any functional policy that makes any kind of sense. The ideas of people like Rubio, John McCain, Paul Wolfowitz, they're not realistic. They're financially impossible, politically unpopular, and militarily disastrous. The main challenge, of course, is that American power abroad will and continue to generate violent opposition. The alliance of China and Russia guarantees that the U.S. will become far more restrained. It has no other choice. The ownership of billions of American dollars suggests that any foreign policy cannot irritate these countries. That's reality that the U.S. can't bomb away. The second issue, of course, is the nature of American allies. Its opposition to American military hegemony throughout the world grows, and really it's not much of a hegemony anymore, because the U.S. military is a failure. It's unlikely that that most EU states will support it. It's already fallen apart. Like the U.S., they too are constrained by debt, lack of public support, and legitimate fear that war with Russia and war with China will be a total disaster. And since Europe is now dealing with an invasion from the Third World, it is disappearing from the planet. The third constraint, of course, is even more domestic than that. The well-known controversies of the Patriot Act, work of Homeland Security, have led to even greater suspicions of Washington from most Americans. And Americans who in years past could be counted on to support a strong military presence abroad. Author in 2005, Cox writes this, "Finally, the success of empires in general, and it could be argued that this is true of the American Empire in particular, has ultimately rested on the ability of the imperial power to deliver a bundle of economic goods in the form of improved living standards, economic opportunity, and growth worldwide. It was this, in large part, that brought the U.S. to victory in the Cold War and self-confidence for most of the 1990s. However, as recent economic events have revealed, only too graphically, none of this can be taken for granted." Now, as far as American scholarship goes, that's about as good as you're going to get, but it's a radically understated case. It's far more of an argument that strategic restraint exists because there's no money. There's a massive crisis of confidence. There was nothing special about the 1990s. I don't know where this guy was in the 90s. There was just as much anger and hatred against the regime in the 90s as it is today. The crisis of confidence and one of complete legitimacy. How can the U.S. claim hegemony when its own variation of liberalism is dying? But Iran is one of the world's great success stories. Her statistics speak for themselves, and the more significant they come from their enemies. Iran has a better standard of living in almost all respects than the U.S. She has a more representative government, a far more responsive media, where the U.S. essentially has two or three major papers owned by Jews. The American press is the most censored on the planet. Except, of course, that it comes from the private sector, so it conveniently lies outside of the definition of censorship. So the U.S. bases its domination on the manipulation of word meanings. In brief, American foreign policy has to reject any concept of liberalism and leadership. It needs to reject the idea that liberalism is viable in any way whatsoever. The rise of China, Iran, as major powers, even beyond the demonic powers, has destroyed the connection between Western liberalism and any economic success, precisely at a time when this success is nowhere to be found. Iran has the exact opposite economic system as the U.S. It is a planned economy. It is a strongly statist economy. And yet we know that it's outperformed the U.S. in every single respect under the most hostile circumstances imaginable. And therefore, Russia and China are creating this new world. And it's done on the corpse of American stupidity. The truth of the matter is that American capitalism is irrational. It wastes resources. You have new product lines being introduced with very minor changes. Consumer electronics contains planned obsolescence. Less than 20% of all American investment domestically is productive. The rest is towards financial products of one kind or another. Currency trades alone absorb a huge proportion. Capitalism wastes money. In other words, less than 20% of all investment is directed to any kind of actual production of goods, wherein 80% is directed to financial products, investments and that kind of thing, currency speculation, speculation on bonds, whatever it might be. Advertising budgets are almost entirely wasteful. I think Pampers has the highest at almost $10 billion a year. Gillette at $8 billion, Chevy at $5 billion, Ford at $4.3 billion, Coke at $4 billion. Billions and billions being wasted on products that everyone knows about. In the UK, The Guardian reports that the privatization of the rail line, bringing it into the capitalist world, led to destructive and wasteful practices. The state-run mainline rail service requires fewer subsidies and user inputs, and uses inputs more sparingly than the remaining 15 privatized rail companies. In the same article from The Guardian, the state-run UK health service is cheaper than the privatized services in the US. Healthcare spending per person is far higher in the USA than in the UK, with inferior results. Japan spends less than half per person than the USA. It has an average life expectancy is close to 80. Cuba has a superior life expectancy and a lower rate of infant mortality than the USA at much lower cost per person. And we've already talked about the Iranian case. There is not a shred of evidence that argues that private ownership is inherently more rational than state ownership. Robert Millward, concerning Britain, says, on new evidence, British total factor productivity growth record in most of the nationalized industries was significantly better than their U.S. counterparts, and better than the whole of the British economy. To be more specific, the average annual rate of total factor productivity growth from 1950 to 1973 was higher in Britain than in the U.S. for airlines, electricity, gas, and coal. The proposition that privatization in Britain led to improvement is contradicted by comparison of these figures with those from 1973 to 1995, when growth rates for airlines, gas, electricity were far lower. State enterprises in Britain compared favorably in productivity growth with comparable sectors in the more privately owned U.S. industry and with privatized regimes that's followed in Britain. So this Millward essay, it comes from a book challenging the doctrine that private sector investments are inherently more effective than the state sector. They are not. He tells us and reminds us that after the Second World War, most British industry was in state hands, leading to a massive post-war boom. On the other hand, privatization led to mass unemployment, monstrous inequality, and extraordinary exploitation. Capitalism is neither efficient nor rational. I'm not talking about the market now, but that's only an abstraction of the local level. But the specific definition of these terms don't matter. They fail on all counts. The gains of capitalism go to the unproductive, bankers, middlemen, not producers, investors, or entrepreneurs. Capital mobility means that a firm can hold an entire community hostage. They can demand low wages and regulations of their walk, destroying an entire area, and of course showing the moral compass of its managers. They demand tax breaks and subsidies in the so-called market system, but they'll go elsewhere. They invest in slave labor regions and then sell the product back to their home countries at prices just below that of domestic producers, thus pocketing an immense, wasteful, and irrational profit. This is the truth of capitalism. This is the truth of the American model. This is the truth of American liberal democracy. which is tightly connected with capitalism. The literature that state-run enterprises, or enterprises with great state control in Russia, China, Iran, Britain, outperformed their private sector counterparts the world over, especially in the U.S., is growing. They did better than the private sector. There is absolutely no reason to believe that state enterprises perform better than private ones. And certainly not using the last 30 years as any kind of baseline. You use the theory that competition leads to efficiency, but there is very little competition. There is collusion. There's domination. There's oligarchy. They meet in groups like, you know, Bohemian Grove or Bilderberg, whatever it is. They collude one with another. There is no competition. There is no reason to believe that a state-run media is any worse than a oligarchy-run media. These are the facts. And we go through the Iranian statistics, as I've elsewhere gone through the Chinese, gone through the Russian, gone through the Belarusian. It proves this over and over again. The Soviet model was a totally different thing. The Soviet model of pure irrationality. It had nothing to do with growth. That all came from the U.S. No, we're talking about a patriotic nationalist state, an idealistic religious state, using directed subsidies to build partnerships with state and private actors. That's what we're talking about here, something completely different. But the myths of capitalism and the so-called invisible hand is just that. It's mythical. And so republicanism, so-called democracy, capitalism, it's all one and the same imperialist juggernaut. And countries like Russia and Iran have shown what the truth of the matter is. That national socialist states outperform capitalist ones any day of the week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioAryan.com.